Our final case this morning is 13-1088, and I believe all counsel were in the room when I announced earlier Chief Justice O'Connor is not able to be with us this morning. She has read the briefs, she will view the oral arguments, and she will fully participate in the deliberations of this matter. Case is Lincoln Electric Company Petitioner versus Travelers Casualty and Surety Company Respondents. For the petitioner, Mr. William Skinner.
Thank you, Justice Pfeiffer, and may it please the court. My name is William Skinner, and I represent the petitioner, Lincoln Electric Company. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. We respectfully submit that the answer to the certified question is yes. Since 2000, this court has twice ruled that under policies like those at issue here, a policyholder is entitled to all sums coverage. In 2002, the court made this all sums determination in the Goodyear case. And in 2010, the court reaffirmed that all sums interpretation in the Park, Ohio case. The question in this case is whether Lincoln Electric forfeited the right to all sums coverage under its umbrella policies when it entered into a settlement agreement with respect to its primary policies in 2000.
Counsel, just to keep the concept simple, at least for me, could you walk us through how the math would work if the answer is yes?
Yes,
Your Honor. In this particular case.
Yes, Your Honor. The record shows that as of the time that the evidence was put in, Lincoln had $91 million of unreimbursed defense and indemnity costs. Approximately 4.6 of that was indemnity, and the rest was defense costs. Of that total, $31 million had been incurred before May 2006. And that money, Lincoln is not entitled to reimbursement for as a result of the settlement, because that money was paid by Lincoln before the attachment point of one of the umbrella policies had been reached. What Lincoln is seeking in this case is the $61 million that it paid after the attachment point of the umbrella policy was reached, because Lincoln's position is that under the all sums interpretation that this court adopted in Goodyear and Park, Ohio, once its indemnity payments, when added to those of the primary insurer, reach the attachment point of the umbrella insurer, the umbrella insurer is obligated to pay all sums incurred thereafter. And that is the result that the Ninth District Court of Appeals adopted in Goodrich in a case that's very similar to the facts of this
case. Was there a settlement in the Goodrich case?
Yes, there was a settlement with the primary insurer that involved multiple policies providing primary coverage over a period of 20 years. And the Ninth District Court of Appeals held that the policyholder was entitled to all sums coverage from a single umbrella policy for all amounts in excess of the attachment point of that policy. There was no requirement that the policyholder demonstrate that all of the primary policies had been exhausted. It was sufficient that one primary policy had been exhausted by payments made either by the insurer or by the policyholder. So that case is on all fours. It is the only appellate decision in Ohio state courts that has addressed this question, and we submit it is the right result and should be followed here. The insurers rely primarily on the decision by the Sixth Circuit in the GenCorp case, which affirmed summarily a decision by a magistrate judge. In our view, that case was wrongly decided. Contrary to this court's ruling in Goodyear, the premise of the GenCorp decision is the false premise that excess insurers only promised to pay a pro rata portion of the loss. This court ruled precisely the opposite. The magistrate judge reasoned that forcing excess insurers to pay all of the losses in excess of their attachment points would mean that the excess insurers would, quote, have to pay more than their contracted for share of GenCorp's liability. But that's the opposite of what this court ruled in Goodyear. This court ruled in Goodyear and in Park, Ohio, that in fact the insurers had promised to pay all sums. The ruling in GenCorp is flatly inconsistent and frankly is an attempt to nullify this court's rulings in Goodyear. Goodrich is faithful to and follows and implements this court's rulings in Goodyear.
Counsel, the idea of settlement here seems to be how the settlement affects the all sums approach. And I understand you're saying that the settlement was not a decision to allocate pro rata for the primary insurer. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is the settlement agreement was precisely that. It was a settlement agreement. And it expressly says that it does not adopt any theory of coverage. And it expressly says that it confers no benefits on non-parties. And it expressly says it is a compromise settlement entitled to all of the protections of Rule 408 of the federal and state rules of evidence. Now that means, the essence of what it means to say it is a settlement agreement is that its terms may not be used to defend a claim against other policies. Allowing an insurance company to take a settlement agreement and to try to use that as a coverage defense under other policies that were not released is contrary to the spirit and the goals of Rule 408 and Ohio's public policy in favor of settlements. Moreover, Your Honor, it was a modified form of proration in the settlement as part of a compromise. It said that St. Paul could allocate the indemnity payments that it makes pro rata. It said nothing about how the indemnity payments that Lincoln makes should be allocated. So nothing in that agreement prevents Lincoln from allocating all of its unreimbursed indemnity payments to a single policy year for the purpose of reaching the attachment of an umbrella policy and exercising its right to get all sums coverage from the umbrella insurer.
And the settling insurance company, St. Paul, was both a primary carrier and an excess carrier, correct?
That's correct.
Can you respond to the comment that somehow contribution rights are impaired by this settlement for the umbrella policy holders? Carriers, rather.
In the particular facts of this case, it's a circular argument. St. Paul is claiming that it cannot obtain contribution from itself, which is a nonsensical. It has lost nothing. It's claiming that it is not recovering everything it should be entitled to recover from itself in its capacity as the primary insurer. That's nonsensical. More broadly, however, Park, Ohio, and Goodyear recognized that contribution would not always be available when an insurer paid all sums coverage. And this is a case where we agree it should not be available because there was a good faith settlement with the primary insurer. In lieu of contribution, however, the umbrella insurers are receiving a very big benefit from the settlement agreement that was made. In this case, on these facts, because the claims that were being paid under the primary settlement agreement are exactly the same claims for which coverage is being sought under the umbrella policies, the umbrella insurers are getting a dollar-for-dollar settlement credit for every single dollar paid under the settlement because it is reducing the net amount of the claim from the umbrella insurers. And we say in this case that is the equitable alternative to a claim for contribution.
But the umbrella insurers that are not St. Paul, are their contribution rights impaired by the settlement with St. Paul?
There's only one. Aetna, which was not a party to the settlement agreement. Aetna is now a corporate affiliate of St. Paul, so it's really a sister company saying, I can't get contribution from another sister company. I want to take money out of one pocket and put it in the other. It really has no economic significance. But more broadly, the more general principle, we think, is that Aetna is also benefiting from the settlement credit under the facts of this case, and we think that is the equitable alternative to contribution that says that it is reason why it's not unfair to hold Aetna and St. Paul to their promise of all sums coverage under the umbrella policies.
But does the settlement agreement specifically reflect all sums coverage?
No, it was a compromise settlement agreement. And what
right,
it says
but, and
is
that compromise settlement agreement gave St. Paul the right to allocate payments to all the others.
It gave
exclusive right, I think.
It gave St. Paul the right only to allocate the payments, the indemnity payments that it made
right.
to the other primary policies.
Okay.
It did not give St. Paul any right to decide how Lincoln's indemnity payments should be allocated. And St. Lincoln is not asking to readjust how the indemnity payments that St. Paul has made under that agreement are allocated. What Lincoln is saying is that it retains the right under the settlement agreement to allocate the indemnity payments that it made to a single policy year in order to reach the attachment point of the umbrella policy. And there's nothing in the settlement agreement that says it cannot do that, and there's nothing in the settlement agreement that releases any rights that Lincoln has under the umbrella policies. And under Ohio law, Lincoln and the terms of the policies, Lincoln has the right to get umbrella coverage on an all sums basis once the attachment point of that policy has been paid, either by a combination of funds paid by the primary insurer and by Lincoln. But this court addressed that issue in the Fulmer case. In the Fulmer case, it was underinsured motorist case. And there were two insurers, and the policyholder settled with the underlying insurer for less than its policy limit and then turned and tried to recover the portion in excess of that limit from the excess insurer. And this court held, as long as the policyholder pays the difference between what it received from the lower insurer and the limit of that insurer's policy, and only went after the excess insurer for the amount in excess of its attachment point, the excess insurer was not prejudiced and was obligated to make coverage for amounts in excess.
Can you talk about that access point? There's no dispute here that the access points on all the umbrellas were reached?
Not on all of them, but on at least one of them. We only have to reach the attachment point of one umbrella policy.
And then you can collect from
that
one.
And then we can go vertically and collect from them. And so the attachment point is $2 million in indemnity payments. And we have said in the alternative it was reached with respect to the 1980-81 umbrella policy, or alternatively issued by Aetna, or alternatively under the 83-84 umbrella policy issued by St. Paul. We're only seeking coverage under one or the other, not both.
Counsel, your friends on the other side have characterized Lincoln Electric's handling of these cases as scorched earth and a no settlement policy. Does any of that matter in terms of recovery?
It doesn't matter, and it's not true. It matters in terms of the credibility of their argument. The defense strategy was put in place back in the 1970s when these claims first started becoming against Lincoln, and they formed the Welding Defense Group with the enthusiastic support of St. Paul and their insurers, who recognized all along it was an incredibly effective strategy. And the proof is in the pudding. The plaintiffs bar wanted to recover $35 to $70 billion from the welding industry as a group for these manganese claims. Lincoln's share of the global settlement of those claims was $5 million. And that's because on the merits and on the facts, they had a very strong defense. And it took a lot of money to make that defense stick, but it did. This is a textbook example of a brilliant tort defense strategy. And the insurers have been the principal beneficiaries of this strategy because their umbrella limits are approximately $400 million. And if this strategy had not worked, those limits would have been exhausted. So it's not true. The other point is St. Paul has always had the right to challenge the reasonableness of any defense cost and to refuse to pay any defense cost that they concluded were unreasonable, and they have paid 98% of the defense cost they were billed. That claim is demonstrably false.
What about the other umbrella insurers, though? Will they have that ability to say, we don't think that your costs are reimbursable, or we're not going to pay those costs? That's a question that gets decided by the federal court down the road?
Your Honor, once they start making payments, whichever umbrella policy makes payments, they will have all the rights under their policy that they have under the terms of their policy and the law with respect to the control of the defense. If they were to come in now and try and second guess everything that had been done and approved by St. Paul, I think that would be manifestly unreasonable, and some neutral third party would say it is unreasonable and what was done was meritorious. But they would have the rights. No one's saying they don't have the rights they have under their policy once they start making payments. They can't sit back and refuse to make any payments and say, even though I'm not making any payments, I get to control the defense. Once they're either ordered by some court to pay or they begin paying, they will have the rights they have under the umbrella policy. So I wanted to reserve the rest of my time for
rebuttal. You've got about a minute left, so if you want to reserve some time for rebuttal, Mr. Skinner, now would be a good time to sit down. representing Travelers, Ms. Forshaw.
Thank you, Justice Pfeiffer, and may it please the court. I'd like to start by making it crystal clear that the umbrella insurers are not here today to nullify Goodyear or overturn it, as Lincoln has suggested in argument and in their brief. We're here to enforce Goodyear and its rationale and equitable underpinnings. The issue that's before this court is whether a policyholder who has selected multiple primary policies to pay on a pro rata equal share basis can do an about face and ask an umbrella carrier to pay on an all sums basis when the underlying policies are continuing to pay and are indisputably not exhausted.
So you're looking at the settlement as a choice of pro rata. Is that what you're saying?
I am, because the settlement, in the settlement, Lincoln agrees that St. Paul should allocate its costs on a pro rata basis. In the settlement, it says that Lincoln will get copies of erosion reports and will have the ability to object to those reports. They got those reports. They saw that the primary policies were being eroded on a pro rata equal share basis and never objected. That's how it's been done. Each and every one of the primary policies has paid on an equal share basis, 38 policies, for the past 14 years. Each and every one of those policies is paying on that basis as we stand here today.
So your client was not a party to the settlement, correct?
St. Paul?
Except for St. Paul and that
in its primary capacity, it was.
Right. And there was nothing in there that presumed to impair the rights of Lincoln Electric against the rest of the umbrella carriers, was there?
There was nothing explicitly in there, but under the policies and under the law, the erosion of the underlying policies have an impact on when an umbrella policy must pay. As a matter of contract law, umbrella policies do not pay unless and until the underlying policies are exhausted.
And so you're arguing exhaustion. I know your briefs talk about that. Are you, with respect to the attachment point, do you have a dispute with opposing counsel on that?
The umbrella policy, the word attachment point is not in the umbrella policies. The umbrella policies say that they respond when underlying insurance is no longer paying.
Is the word exhaustion in the policies?
It is. It is, Your Honor. I would ask you to look in the St. Paul policy by way of example, and it's at page S35 of the supplement that I submitted with my brief, at Roman numeral 2B, which says explicitly that the St. Paul policy does not respond when underlying insurance is paying for defense and settlement costs. I'd also ask you to look at Roman numeral 3 of the St. Paul policy, which, and I'm going to...
But the St. Paul policy was covered by the settlement agreement, correct?
And the St. Paul, I'm talking about the St. Paul umbrella policy, Your Honor.
But wasn't that all part of the package, the settlement package, regarding the primary insurance as well as St. Paul's
umbrella? No, Your Honor. Let me take a step back. In 2000, Lincoln and St. Paul reached a settlement of 38 primary policies. The settlement said that payments would be made under the 38 primary St. Paul policies on an equal share pro rata basis. It did not resolve coverage as to the umbrella excess policies that bring us here today. Our point, Your Honor, is that Goodyear allows a policyholder such as Lincoln Electric to pick a policy to pay. But as you know from the Park, Ohio case, that is a remedy that is based in equity. There are limits to the selection abilities that a policyholder can exercise. A policyholder must respect the terms and conditions of the policy it's targeting to pay. If the targeted policy is not up to the plate and doesn't have an obligation to pay, the policyholder can't select that policy to pay. In addition, Goodyear is founded on a recognition that a policyholder can target a policy to pay. That policy may pay all sums, but the targeted insurer can then turn around and exercise contribution rights and collect monies back to make sure it hasn't paid more than its fair share.
Counsel, is it your position, if I follow that theory to its logical conclusion, that all 38 policies must be exhausted before umbrella kicks in?
That's right. And
the definition of exhausted would be we have paid the checks as of today, we're paying no more.
The $29 million in remaining primary policy limits need to be paid out before Lincoln is entitled to make its next policy selection. And we base that in part on paragraph 12 of the Goodyear decision, which says that a policyholder can select a policy to pay. To the extent the policy doesn't pay the entire claim, the policyholder can then choose another policy to pay. Here, they have chosen 38 policies to pay. Those policies have paid $107 million of defense costs, $9 million thereabouts of indemnity, and the policies are available to pay another $29 million of costs.
Doesn't each umbrella policy sit on top of a primary policy for a period of time?
It does.
So if I understood it correctly, we're talking about a loss. And if I understood counsel, we're talking about two policies here, one potentially being Aetna and one potentially St. Paul. And the underlying primary policies have been reached, that the loss is greater than the primary, so that you can then go to the excess carrier. That's what I understand.
That is their argument.
And then because of Goodyear, the fact that we have multiple claims over a period of time, according to Goodyear, the entire loss can be looked at, and the umbrella policy would then kick in, not to exceed the ceiling that was bargained for. And if everything is collected from one carrier, that carrier then can go to the other umbrellas and ask for contribution. The all sums approach?
But it can also go to primary carriers and obtain contribution. Therein lies the problem. The umbrella carriers who are in the situation that my client is in are not able to get contribution from the other 36 primary policies that Lincoln selected to pay by the 2000 settlement agreement, because Lincoln released those primary policies. Those primary policies have an obligation to pay only in accordance with the settlement agreement. If the umbrella carrier said, hey, primary insurer, pay me back because I've paid more than my fair share of defense costs, the primary insurer in this circumstance wouldn't have to pay because they've been released by Lincoln. The other issue that I would note about your hypothetical is that your hypothetical description of how umbrella insurance works assumes that the primary, underlying primary beneath the targeted umbrella policy has been exhausted. That's not the case here. The two underlying policies, the policies that underlie the Aetna umbrella and the St. Paul umbrella, one has $850,000 of remaining limits still available. The primary insurer is to this day continuing to pay claims under that policy. The other policy has $1.2 million of primary limits available, and it too is paying claims under the policy.
And you're saying that those would never be credited against the liability of the excess carriers? As I understood it, the credit was going to be given not only for the insurance that was paid to Lincoln Electric as primary insurance, but also the credit was going to be from Lincoln Electric for amounts that it was going to contribute up to the point of attachment on an excess policy.
Let me tell you my problem with that argument. What Lincoln has said, and it said this for the first time in 2011, is that in its view, the primary policies were fictionally or imputed exhausted as of May of 2006. So in 2011, they approached us for the very first time and said, pay us $46 million. And by the way, they did it by the complaint in this action. That was the first we heard of this
demand. You had no notice before that?
No, we had no notice. They filed the complaint and they sent it to us before service. So they came to us, said, pay us this $46 million. And by the way, your primary policies we deem to have been exhausted way back in May of 2006. Well, the problem with this credit argument that they're making, and they brought up in their reply brief, it's an after-the-fact justification. My clients from May of 2006 through 2011 paid under these supposedly exhausted policies, day in, day out, millions of defense costs, indemnity costs as well. This imputed exhaustion is just an invention to justify an attempt to, out of the blue, put a $46 million bill on our client.
Counsel, I asked Mr. Skinner for the math if we answered yes. What's the math if we answer no? Because I'm still unclear.
Sure.
If you take, as Justice Lansinger has indicated, the primary policies, and they're out of it now. Is that correct?
No, they're still paying. Every one of the 38 primary policies, people are in Hartford right now writing checks under each and every one of the 38 primary policies. They're not out of it.
Okay.
They've settled, though. They've settled, and there has been a determination of what the liability is for the primary policies.
The settlement did not reduce the policy limits. All the settlement did was put in place a payment scheme. It said every penny of the primary policy limits are available to pay welding rod claims. The limits weren't reduced at all. But this is how we're going to pay out the claim.
Counsel, I guess you've confused me now. If they are paying, if the primary policy carriers are paying today, why have the umbrella policies been paying from 2006 to 2011?
They have not been paying. I'm sorry if
I thought you just said that you started paying in 2006.
No, the primary policies have been paying. So they say the primary policies were exhausted in May of 2006. That was news to us.
Exhausted is a term of art. It's policy limits, is it not?
The policy limits were not exhausted. We have policy limits on the books from May of 2006 through 2011. The primary policies that they say are exhausted, which entitles them to access the umbrella coverage, have been paying continuously for the last 8 years.
So your position is, by the terms of your policy, you don't owe a dime until they're all exhausted?
We don't owe a dime until Lincoln has exhausted the 38 selected primary policies. And when those 38 primary policies are exhausted collectively, Lincoln is then entitled to select the next policy to pay. And if it would like to select an umbrella policy to pay on an all sums basis, after it's seen through the consequences of its first selection, it's free to do so.
Counsel, even though you just referred to exhaustion, doesn't the limit of liability provision also speak to reduction? Can you address the point that Lincoln makes on
sure.
that issue?
The limit of liability provision in the St. Paul policy actually refers to exhaustion. In the Aetna policy, the paragraph 2.3 of the Aetna policy makes it clear that the Aetna policy does not have to respond and pay for defense and settlement costs when the underlying policy is still paying. I think they are trying to read out of the policies the discussions of the defense provisions in Roman numeral 3 of the St. Paul policy.
Maybe this is a little too simplistic, but my understanding was, you know, we could fill the gap. We could decide to pay the mm-hmm. additional amount of money that would get us to that attachment point. Do you disagree with that they have that option?
I disagree in this circumstance. The Fulmer case and the other gap-filling cases that Mr. Skinner referenced in his argument are cases that were decided in a totally different context. They are cases that were decided in the situation where there was a settlement with primary insurers, and the limits of the primary policy were reduced.
So
the limits were not reduced. Every penny will be paid to Lincoln.
But just so I understand your point, you're not suggesting that there could never be a reduction and a gap that's filled, but they can't do it under this circumstance.
They can't
correct?
Do it under this okay. circumstance. If the settlement had said, let's cut the face amount of the primary policy limits in half, we'd be in a different world. But that's not the world we're in. The primary policies are available to be paid in full and will be paid in full, potentially.
Did you say that one of the reasons that you can't go to the all sums approach is because the umbrella carrier would be prejudiced because the other policies, Lincoln has released them?
I did say that, and it's in the settlement agreement. It explicitly, the settlement agreement contains a mutual release where the primary...
Well, I'm confused a bit because you say they've been released, but they're still paying.
They're released from paying in any way other than is set forth in the settlement agreement.
In the settlement agreement.
Right.
So there's no obligation to comply with contract terms, only the terms of what the settlement is that has been struck between Lincoln Electric and St. Paul.
That's right. That's right.
And as far as prejudice, though, the umbrellas would never be asked to pay more than they contracted for.
I would agree with that, but if the umbrella carriers are asked to pay now, they
would... So it's a timing issue.
It's an acceleration issue. That's right. That's right. And I'd also note, I haven't had a chance to mention it, but I would note that the umbrella insurers have the right to take over the defense of claims by presenting us in 2011 with a bill for defense costs that went back to 2006 for the first time. That's highly inequitable to expect us to pay that. And I also think, Justice Lenziger, that it's inconsistent with the Park, Ohio decision, which I know you authored, which says that a policyholder, when exercising its all sums rights, needs to do so in a cooperative way with the targeted insurer. Here, to present an insurer with a bill of 5 years of past defense costs in a complaint for the first time without giving the insurer the ability to actually get involved in the defense, I would submit is violative of the Park, Ohio cooperation guidance.
So you're saying that you had the excess carriers had no notice until suit was filed, no notice of any of this going on?
We certainly knew about the claims, but we were not told that we were up to the plate and we were expected to pay those claims.
Well, I mean, weren't they talking about sums like $91 million?
Sure, but those sums...
You didn't think the excess would be at issue with that kind of money?
No, because the erosion chart showed that there were millions and millions of dollars of collective limits available to be paid under the 2000 settlement agreement under the primary policy.
And just so I understand what you're saying that in your view, any one of the excess policies that would have been sitting on top of one primary policy... Every one of those excess policies was not to be activated until all of these 38 underlying primary policies were exhausted. That's
correct.
Your view.
That's our view, that they exercised their right to choose policies to pay under Goodyear. They selected 38 policies to pay, and when the collective limits of those policies are exhausted, they're free to choose on an all sums basis for an umbrella carrier to pay.
And if they hadn't settled, if they had not settled anything, would your view be different?
It would be. It would be. But by choosing to settle, they've interfered with our ability to get contribution. And so that is the reason why we believe they need to see through the consequences.
And the contribution would be what? What contribution are you defeated on?
The umbrella carriers, in a normal circumstance, when it's asked to pay all sums, can turn to primary carriers and other excess carriers and ask them to pay them back for their fair share of the claim payment. Remember, these claims are progressive injury claims,
right?
So they trigger multiple policies.
Right.
So an insurer can seek some recompense from the other insurers
on
the risk.
I thought you were saying that if Lincoln, this is where I'm still at sea on this. They agreed to a settlement. You're saying, well, there's still money in play. But if Lincoln is stepping up to the plate and saying, we're going to absorb some difference here between the underlying policies, and when you get to the umbrellas, and now it's your turn, you know, what's the complaint there?
The complaint is, first, that was consideration they paid to buy the right to control the defense. We weren't party to that agreement. We don't think we should have to pay their consideration.
And you believe the defense was improper? The cases were not well defended?
We believe it was a scorched earth defense, that if an insurer was in control,
it would have been cheaper to just pay the claims and not the lawyers.
No, or it would have been perhaps more efficient to pay less lawyers. I think my partners will shoot me for saying that. But in many of these cases, 4 and 5 law firms were retained. I think if claims handlers from my clients were involved, those decisions might not have been made. We certainly should have been given the opportunity to make those decisions.
And if we, you believe you're foreclosed from litigating those questions ever?
I believe,
if we answer this yes.
No, I believe that many of these questions will be sorted out in the district court.
Yeah. But you'll still have a fair shot at too many lawyers.
Yes.
All of the questions about the scorched earth policy.
Yes, and I've raised questions about the veracity of the billing that my client received and other issues. But the issue before the court here today, the allocation issue, I think is...
Well, I'm trying to understand the equities of the arguments as well. And if Lincoln is saying, we'll foot the bill for the gap between the 38 primaries, what were each $2 million?
Yes.
All right, so that's what, 76 million? And if they only pay 50, Lincoln will fill in the other 26 million, and now we're on your nickel. How is that inequitable?
My concern is it turns insurance law on its head. I don't know of any decision anywhere in the country that has found that a primary insurer and an umbrella insurer's policies are triggered at the same time on a continuous basis and are funding claims at the same time. They have not cited any case. This court would be the first court to say that an umbrella insurer should pay before the underlying primary policy is exhausted. Our primary policies are going to continue to pay over time.
But if they exhaust it by saying, we'll fill the gap, that's unfair.
In our view, it's unfair because it would accelerate our obligations. And to the extent there is a gap to fill, that gap should be viewed as the collective limits of the policy, not just one policy.
If we answer in the affirmative, you'll still be in federal court. You'll still be able to say, too many lawyers, too many high-priced lawyers, too many experts, and will you be able to get the other umbrella carriers to contribute?
Well, the other umbrella carriers are probably going to stand up and say the same thing I am, which is, we're not up to the plate. The underlying primary is not exhausted.
But it's one company doesn't get tagged all by itself.
You know, I think that's actually a non-substantive response to the question you posed. You folks set the law for the state of Ohio. In most situations like this, you're going to have a primary carrier who is not in the same family as an umbrella carrier. So I think you need to look at this in an academic way. I would say that I think it would be unfair to dismiss this dispute and say we can just do some bookkeeping changes and move some money between accounts. That's not how insurance accounting works. We have reserve considerations. We have reinsurance considerations. My clients just can't move money back and forth between policies at will.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving me extra time.
Mr. Skinner, we'll give you a little extra time as well.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Let me say first that the umbrella insurers have been on notice of these claims for many, many years and have been receiving regular reports not only about the number of claims and the status of the claims, but the costs. And they recognized in internal memos, which are cited in our brief, that their umbrella policies were exposed and implicated.
Do they have any opportunity? So five sets of law firms, scorched earth. And they're sitting back there and saying, wow.
But they weren't.
They're chewing up the primaries at an incredible rate, and this is not being managed well. If they believe that, do they have any right to do anything until they're in play?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The facts are that St. Paul and Aetna were watching the defense and we're congratulating Lincoln on what a great job it was doing, and that St. Paul accepted.
Is that in the record?
Yes.
All right.
In the memos we cited in our brief, and that St. Paul agreed that 98% of the defense costs were reasonable. This is a fiction created for argument to you based on zero evidence in the record.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time.
Right.
Well, counsel, if we're writing a fiction, I need the final chapter for the fiction. Under the terms of the settlement, will the primary policies ever be exhausted?
May I address that very clearly in context, though, Justice O'Neill?
I kind of thought it was a yes or no question.
It is a yes or no question, but if I may. What counsel for the insurers said is if we had not settled at all, we could have gone on an all-sums basis after paying $2 million in indemnity payments and gotten everything vertically from an umbrella insurer. But because we settled, they said, we magically increased the attachment point of every umbrella policy from $2 million to $76 million. Because now, instead of having to just do the attachment point of one umbrella policy and one primary policy, we now have to exhaust all 38 primary policies. There is nothing in the primary settlement agreement that says that. There is nothing in the umbrella policies that says that. There is nothing in Ohio law that says that.
Counsel, is by the terms of this settlement, taking one primary insurance company that has a $2 million policy, does the settlement let them leave the table with $1.8 million or another number, less than $2 million?
What we say is that if you allow us to go up either under 1980 or 81 or 83 or 84, whichever one ultimately is chosen, the primary policy under that is selected, whichever year it is, has no further obligations to pay anything after May 2006 when its attachment point was reached. We have not, in our allocation analysis, allocated any nickel to those policies after May 2006. Now, they don't accept that allocation, so they're doing whatever they're doing. But
so then your answer to my question has to be no, that by that scenario, those primary policies will never be exhausted at policy limits, will they?
Yes, they will. Yes, they will, Your Honor, because the way they're exhausted is by adding together what the insurer paid plus what Lincoln paid to fill the gap. And the effect of that is to exhaust that policy and to mean that that policy doesn't have to pay anything more, either for an indemnity or defense costs. And her point that coverage is still available under the primary policies, there is no coverage available under the primary policies for the $91 million of unreimbursed costs as a result of the settlement agreement. It's only the unreimbursed costs that we are seeking coverage from the umbrella policies for, and there is no primary coverage available for those costs.
So the timing issue, that's what I'm wondering about here. Are you saying that this $91 million is really set in stone now? It's been determined, and that we're talking about the percentage that the policies, the primary policies will pay, the gap that will be made up by Lincoln, but the amount that the exposure for the umbrella policies is set, or is it not set?
These are ongoing claims, so there are still defense costs being incurred and have been. The $91 million was as of a point in time. Since that time, there have been additional costs incurred. However, if you were to accept their position that the attachment point went up to $76 million, Lincoln will never recover a nickel from its umbrella policies because there is no reasonable prospect that that amount of money will ever be paid in settlements or judgments of these kinds.
And according to their position, if you hadn't settled at all, you could have waited, or you could have immediately, after $2 million, gone to one excess carrier and received that level of insurance.
And think about what that says about the effect of a settlement. By entering into a compromise settlement that expressly said it was not adopting any theory of coverage and that the settlement agreement itself couldn't be used as a defense to coverage for claims under other policies. That's what Rule 408 means. They're saying the settlement agreement converted the attachment point from $2 million to $76 million. That is outrageous.
What it really says, Mr. Skinner, is you've done such a great job defending the claims that there's so much money left to pay them that you can never exhaust it because you're doing such a great job defending them.
That's right. The indemnity
exactly
payments.
Exactly the argument.
The indemnity payments will there is no reasonable prospect in sight that the indemnity payments are going to ever equal $76 million.
So if you lay down
under their theory,
lay down on the defense and pay out all the claims,
right,
then you can get there.
Exactly. Exactly.
So the $91 million, that's actually been paid to lawyers and consultants and experts?
That is
Lincoln.
That's the money that Lincoln has paid as of a certain date for which it did not receive any reimbursement from the primary insurers as a result of the settlement agreement. And Lincoln is saying some portion of that they have to pay without ever reimbursement. They have to pay the $31 million that they incurred before the indemnity payments got to the limit of the primary policy in May 2006. So they have to eat that. That's the price to Lincoln of having compromised and settled. And they pay that price. We're not asking to get that back. But we're saying that the price of the settlement was not forfeiting coverage that would otherwise be available under the umbrella policies in accordance with the terms of those policies and applicable law. GenCor is the only decision that has gone the other way, and three courts have said GenCor is inconsistent with your all sums ruling. The Sixth Circuit said it in the Bondex case. In the Bondex case, they followed Goodrich, and they said that the excess insurer had to pay everything above the attachment point.
I know you're out of time, but can you address your counsel's argument that says we really don't have primary carriers paying indemnity claims at the same time we have umbrella carriers paying those claims because the umbrella is never triggered until the primary is exhausted?
With all respect,
there isn't any precedent, I think, for that kind of scheme. And if we write this law this way, my goodness, I can imagine we're going to have all sorts of claims being filed against all sorts of carriers, primary, umbrella, and we'll have duplicate defenses, apparently.
Your Honor,
how do we write this?
Sure. I can't point to a specific case,
okay,
because I'm not aware of one, but many cases have said that you can go up vertically without exhausting all primary policies, and we've cited a bunch of them in our reply brief. What I can say, Your Honor, is that happens all the time in the real world. If you have a typical coverage cart with early policies going back to the 50s and then 85 or 86 when environmental and asbestos coverage changed, the limits are typically lower in the earlier years. When you allocate losses, whether you're doing it by prorating them, even if you settle in an all sums jurisdiction, the settlements typically will recognize the contribution rights. And so the settlement agreements or the courts will maybe let you go vertically once, but then they start allocating it. So you start exhausting the policies at different amounts based on when the exposure first started and when it ended. And because cases move back, you typically exhaust the later policies at a more rapid rate than the early policies because every claim is having some portion of the loss allocated to the later policies, and only some claims are having portions of the loss allocated to the early. So the policies exhaust at different rates, and some of the early primary policies will still be in effect with unexhausted limits when the later policies have exhausted their limits. And what often happens in those cases is the umbrella insurer over that later time period drops down and picks up its share. That's the way it often works in reality. That's the way it often works in settlements.
Thank you.
Mr. Skinner, before you sit down, my thought is back to you're saying, well, we were hearing from umbrella carriers that we're doing, the company is doing such a fine job defending these, and this scorched earth policy is working well. Were they hearing from umbrella carriers other than the ones who were also primary?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, the facts are...
That's not much of a selling point if you're hearing from the same company that's
right
at the plate at the moment.
St. Paul is the primary insurer for the whole time period and the umbrella insurer for most of the time period, and they were closely involved in all of it. And we're complimentary about the defense.
But were others?
Aetna is the only other umbrella insurer, and Aetna also has internal memos that are cited in our brief, complimenting or acknowledging that the strategy of defense was very effective and was aggressive.
If we were to say yes, answer the question yes, we would be affirming that Ohio is an all sums jurisdiction, and
yes,
that a settlement does not forfeit that. The allocation on that basis.
Right, and I would urge you to look at the Supreme Court of Wisconsin decision in the Appleton Papers case, which says GenCorp is inconsistent with all sums. The Sixth Circuit has said that, and in the Indiana trial court case and the Dana case, they say GenCorp is an outlier. It's inconsistent with all sums coverage.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Case is submitted, and thank you, Mr. Skinner and Ms. Forshaw, for coming to Columbus and presenting us with very cogent arguments on your behalf. Marshall, if you would, please adjourn court.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.